Yes.
Could you talk about misconceptions about enlightenment? It seems like they're probably rampant. I wouldn't know. So just, you know, based on your work with others, what's, you know, all these things that are floating around the media and talk space, and then also your own things that you've, you know, seen stripped away. Maybe enlightenment in general and first stage stream entry kind of enlightenments in particular.
Interesting topic.
Yeah.
Beginning with misperceptions. Well, probably the biggest misperception of all, which is quite understandable considering the nature of enlightenment, is that you get enlightened. That's probably the biggest misperception. Whereas it's yeah. But there are a lot of misperceptions about of different kinds about what an enlightened person is like and how it happens. And actually, that would be an interesting thing just to kind of survey the room to see what sorts of things that people have heard, read, or impressions that they picked up as to how enlightenment happens and what an enlightened person is like. Yes.
I just read today, somebody said that an arhat is infallible.
Uh-huh.
Is that a conception?
Infallible.
Is that a misconception?
Was that written by an arhat?
Well, I think that's part of the misconception is the idea that goes along with the idea of omniscience and things like that, that arhats and enlightened beings have the kinds of properties that have been traditionally said to belong to God or gods, godlike properties. And only the Pope is infallible. Just in that regard, I'll share with you what one of the sutras says about the Buddha himself, which is that he gave the teaching on the there's a meditation on the body as being disgusting, and according to the sutras, he gave that teaching, and then after he had given that teaching, he went into a private retreat that lasted some lengthy period of time. I don't remember what, a couple of months, 3 months, something like that. And when he came out of the retreat, he found that some 36 of his followers had committed suicide as a result of his teachings on the foulness of the body. So, what would be your impression of that?
Oops.
It kind of sounds like I set it up, right? And but I'll tell you how it's handled in the commentaries, which were written long after the Buddha passed away. And these guys that provided the commentaries, of course, had the inside track on everything somehow. They said that this particular group of bhikkhus all just happened to have the karma to commit suicide anyway. And the Buddha knew that. And so he gave this particular teaching the way he did so that they would get that done and over with and get reborn and start having a new shot at things. I mean, really, the question of infallibility is could a Buddha make mistakes? The other question, the other way in which could be fallible, could some of the teachings of the Buddha be mistaken? Now, there's an interesting question, because, you see, when I read the sutras, I don't find that the Buddha ever taught reincarnation at all. He went along with it, because that's what everybody believed in. And he sometimes made references to it as a part of his teaching. But he never taught reincarnation as a fact. But it has become a part of Buddhist religion, established as a part of Buddhist religion to accept the version of reincarnation that was established prior to the birth of the Buddha. And so that's carried down as a part of religious Buddhism. Now, there are some teachers, including one who was a guest and spoke here just a few weeks ago, who, he says the Buddha was mistaken. The Buddha did teach reincarnation, but that was a mistake. So he's willing to say the Buddha's fallible in terms of teaching things that aren't true. But all that I've studied and all that I've practiced and all that I've learned on my own and compared to what the Buddha taught, I would say when it comes to the things that he really taught, there's no mistakes there. That part of it's infallible. But if somebody'd ask him which horse to bet on, he'd die. I think he could have messed up. If he'd been willing to answer at all, of course, but you know. I'll tell you where some of these ideas come from, though. The Buddha was revered, and he was established in the minds of his followers, and not just his immediate followers, but the generations of followers that came afterwards, as representing the ultimate attainment that was possible for human beings. So a Buddha is essentially defined as the ultimate of what's possible. And so it's mostly in the commentaries that you find this too. So if you go through the commentaries, you'll find in many different places, you'll find lists of qualities of a Buddha. Descriptions of things about the way a Buddha is in the commentaries. And if you assemble them all together, which a scholar has done, I believe his name is Paul Griffiths, in a book that's called Being Buddha. Not sure I have his name right, but I have the name of the book right, Being Buddha, which is really, it's a horribly difficult book to read. It's one of these scholarly things. It's written the way I used to write. But he's gone through all of these commentarial texts from several different traditions and put them all together and assembled all the information in categories and the chapters. And basically what it comes down to is if you start with the premise that a Buddha is the ultimate that can be achieved, then all these characteristics follow from that presumption. And omniscience is one of them, infallibility, all these kinds of things. These are all qualities that are traditionally in Buddhism regarded as qualities of the Buddha, of any Buddha. But you have to keep in mind where they come from. They didn't even come from the man that we give the title Buddha to. Buddha means awakening. They didn't come, he neither taught that this is how Buddhas are, nor are they based on observations of how he was. They were the logical result of the presumption, of the axiomatic assumption that a Buddha, to be a Buddha, had to be the penultimate of whatever he was.
It was along the lines of the misconceptions. From my work with Mind and Life, I've gotten to meet a lot of these very sort of high up Buddhist teachers and scholars, and some of them are very wonderful, but a number of them are really intolerable. They're mean and petty and controlling, have sort of all the vices of regular people, but like amplified. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I heard this one teacher say that if you're a stinker before you're enlightened, you're a stinker after you're enlightened. I was wondering about sort of like personality characteristics, like agreeability and pleasantness, you know, whether you would say that these people who are really difficult to get along with and are generally regarded to be enlightened, whether enlightenment doesn't necessarily wipe that out, or whether they might be misrepresenting themselves.
So I want to restate your question. So your question is, can you summarize your
question? Yeah, so the question is it the case that people could be enlightened and still kind of unpleasant and bad at getting along with others? Or are those qualities, if a person claims enlightenment and has those qualities, is it false that the person is enlightened?
Okay. Could a person be enlightened and still be obnoxious?
Yeah.
And there's two things here. When we say enlightened, are we talking about stream enter? Are we talking about arhat? Or are we talking somewhere in between? A stream enter can still be obnoxious. The farther somebody is along in the path, the less likely they are to be obnoxious. Let's put it this way, the less likely they are to be unskillful and to be what they're said to be, or what we're assuming that we are, what they are when we say that they are somewhere on the path between stream entry and arhatship. If they're somewhere along there, then they're somewhere in the process of eradicating compulsive behaviors that come from desire and aversion of every kind, and from the conviction that they are a separate self. They also will have completely seen through the illusion that they are their ego self. Okay? So someone who's anywhere on that spectrum would only manifest an egocentric behavior sort of in a state of extreme unskillfulness and thoughtlessness, and will recognize it soon afterward. The farther along they are in the process, the less likely that is to happen. Okay? So, and that I have absolutely no mistake and no question about in my mind. These changes that we call enlightenment are real. They really do happen. They really do involve, number one, realizing that you are not your ego construct. That doesn't mean you cease to have an ego construct, because you do have one. You will continue to have one. Even as a Buddha, you will have one. But as soon as you become a stream enterer, you will not believe you are that ego construct. As a stream enterer, out of habit, out of conditioning, out of unskillfulness, out of lapses in mindfulness, you may revert to behaving in conditioned ways that are based in the attachment to your ego construct. But you cannot go very far without realizing what you're doing, because you're doing something that's so totally stupid. It's like when you find yourself putting the garbage in the dishwasher. You only get so far, and then you realize. And there are two really strong clues that are always going to alert you to when you're doing that. One is, in the process of doing that, you're going to become unhappy. You're going to be generating the causes for your own suffering. The second is that the things that you're saying and doing are going to make the people around you unhappy. So sooner or later, you're going to notice one or the other or both of those things, and you'll realize you're putting the garbage in the dishwasher, right? And you'll stop. But the further along the process you go, the less likely that it is to happen. In what's referred to as the second stage of enlightenment, you have enormously weakened the tendency to actually act out of compulsions of desire and aversion. They are still there. You still feel them, but they no longer have the power that they did before. Because they don't have the power they did before, and because they are precisely the cause of the kinds of actions that you're talking about that are obnoxious, that would make somebody else unhappy, that would be destructive or harmful or so on and so forth, they're far, far less likely to arise at all. So, you know, you'll never get as far as the situation that I described before. The third stage is where you are no longer subject to compulsions of desire and aversion at all. And so there's a whole range of human behaviors that are not going to arise in you because there's no reason for them. The source, the cause, is not going to happen. There's still, even with somebody who's a non-returner, there's still a habitual component. A non-returner might, in a relaxed conversation with somebody, hear themselves saying the kinds of things that they've said all their life, and in that moment realize, what am I saying? Right? And of course, they'll stop. But it doesn't mean that it won't happen. But if it manifests as a dominant kind of behavior, you know, if somebody's doing this kind of thing all the time, saying these kinds of things repeatedly and obliviously to what they're doing, then they obviously have not, they're still being driven by those compulsions. They don't, you know, they're not at a point where they will recognize those things. So, now, when you get to an arahat has no longer has the subjective experience of being a separate self. What that means is that there's absolutely no root at all for any kind of selfish behavior. And there is the total realization of the interconnectedness of everything and everyone, the very essence of no longer having the sense of being a separate self is the essence of the oneness of all things and all beings. So an arhat, I don't see how an arhat could possibly do or say something that is, you know, any more than a person would jab the back of their hand with a fork to keep their left hand from grabbing the last piece of carrot on their plate or something. You know, it doesn't make sense. Because they don't see that kind of separateness. They don't experience that kind of separateness. So I think you can discern whether or not somebody has achieved the specific qualities that the Buddha himself identified as those belonging to an enlightened being, and those that we do see in the world that people do achieve.
Yeah, so I guess then that really answers the question, and I guess makes it seem like Buddhism is probably, you know, similar to every other religion, that there's a lot of people who, you know, kind of like the Wizard of Oz, brilliant guru persona until you get closer, and probably if you were kind of obnoxious and people treated you as though you were a guru, that would make you an awful lot worse. I think probably that's what I've been seeing. Yeah.
There's a classic study that was done many years ago. It's never been replicated. You're probably familiar with it. But they took a relatively large number of people. I think it was like 2 or 3 dozen people, something like that. I'm really not good with details, but it feels like several dozen. Who, all of whom, were supposed to be at one level or another of the four stages of enlightenment, according to their teacher or according to some consensus of their colleagues, or, you know, there was some criteria by which they were being identified as being a stream enterer or a once returner, a non-returner, an arhat. And they did several different kinds of tests, but the most important one they did, the main one they did, was with the Rorschach. Are you familiar with this thing?
No, I never heard of it.
Hmm?
No, I never heard
You're
of it.
You're not? Oh, well. I'll have to send you the reference to it. What they found in this study, and it's something that I feel like I've observed too, is that when somebody becomes enlightened, eccentricities, peculiarities of personality, are actually exaggerated. They're enhanced. They stand out much, much more. So an enlightened person might appear kind of weird. They're not trying to hurt anybody else, and they're not trying to aggrandize themselves. They're just quirky. and they become, you know, they tend to become, they don't require new quirks necessarily, but the quirks that they already have, either they're more free to express them or, you know, whatever. So you might find enlightened beings are quirky, but not obnoxious. Although you've got to keep in mind, obnoxiousness is in the mind of the beholder, too. Yeah?
Actually, I had two questions. One that came up from this discussion that was, you know, it's been said that sometimes teachers who are very far advanced, or even the Dalai Lama, I've heard at some point, can sometimes, in order to teach a student, may say something that sounds mean or can sound harsh to others. So I wondered what your opinion or your thoughts on that were. If you had heard that or experienced it, or, you know, or what do you think about the idea that there's wisdom in somebody doing something like that?
Well, now this is, I'm glad you brought this up. This is something that I'm sure probably all of you have heard, encountered, read about sometime or another, is the idea that an enlightened being might sometimes engage in what appears to be atrocious or unfair or inappropriate behavior, but in really doing it for the benefit of the person that they're doing it to, because they understand that person's mind so well, that by doing this they're going to bring this person to a new state of understanding, insight, enlightenment of their own. Right? You all heard this one form or another? And now, the Buddha definitely scolded his students when they did something that was inappropriate, or especially if they held some mistaken belief and taught it to others, he would scold them thoroughly and publicly. And this sounds harsh, but that doesn't mean that he's doing it with the... I would say that it, for these kinds of things, it's fairly obvious that his only intention is to provide the kind of guidance to the person that he's responsible for providing. That's the way that seems to me. You know, that scolding, for example, scolding the fisherman's son, Sati, when the fisherman's son, Sati, who was a pretty smart fellow, trying to solve this riddle of what is there about a person that could be reborn, came to the conclusion that it was consciousness, vijnana, or vijnana in Sanskrit. And he thought he had figured it out, and he started going around telling people that. And when the Buddha was told of this, you know, he said, "You foolish man, where on earth did you ever get that idea? You did not get that idea from me." And he just turned up one side down the other. Which is really interesting, considering how much of traditional Buddhism today still contains the idea that somehow there's a stream of consciousness which is what's reborn from one life to the next.
You should yell at them.
They need to be yelled at. Actually, Shinzen did a really good job at yelling. Anyway, but I can see his motivation. Shinzen was a bright guy, and he'd gotten off track and made a mistake. The Buddha wanted to straighten him out. And even more so, did I say the wrong thing?
Yes, yeah, Shinzen. Oh, yes.
Who knows? Words come through me. It's just the vehicle. Sati. That's what the Buddha was doing with Sati. And even more so, Sati was going around teaching this to other people as being the teaching of the Buddha. So he had to correct that. And so scolding him. And I'm sure it hurt his feelings. But it wasn't about hurting his feelings or not hurting his feelings. And that, I think, explains the way that the Buddha treated different people. But I hear stories, and I have seen myself instances where a teacher, for example, might belittle or ridicule somebody, and everybody else is, oh, they're doing it for their own good. And you look at the situation, there is no way. And not only that, this person, after they finish crying and being upset and everything else, they're not any more enlightened about anything than they started. And sometimes even they are less inclined to continue following the teaching. And also you hear stories and maybe have seen examples of teachers that engage in behavior that is not judged as acceptable in general. And we're told, oh, this is just, you know, enlightened beings aren't subject to the same kind of, you know, rules. This is crazy wisdom. And they're doing this to teach us, to help us to understand. And yet, you see, the effect it's having is that people are severely disturbed, unhappy, angry, leave that teacher, and sometimes leave the Dharma teachings entirely. So it doesn't look like it produces the kind of results that are claimed for it. And, you know, to me, it's not at all impossible that a teacher may, in an act of wisdom, and these teachers are locked, they're fallible. So I'm saying that somebody could try to do this but be making a mistake. It's possible that a teacher, as an act of wisdom, could choose to do something that would appear to somebody else to be inappropriate, to be harmful. But it really is the wise thing to do, which is known to the teacher that he was successful and did something wise, because the student actually learns and grows and is more enlightened as a result of it. That's definitely possible. It's, yeah, definitely possible. But the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah.
you know, it's in, did the person actually gain some significant understanding, some significant insight as a result? And by significant, it's got to be significant enough to justify whatever it was that was done and the effect it had. So that's certainly possible, it's completely possible. But I believe that most of the instances that you might ever hear about are just rationalization for people who are not so enlightened as they either think or would like you to believe, who want to make excuses for inappropriate behavior. That's what I think. Yes?
Well, I agree, first of all. That's what I thought. Thank you. The other question had to do with reincarnation. You were talking about how the Buddha did not teach reincarnation. And so I'm curious as to then what are your thoughts on reincarnation? And, you know, I mean, how it relates to karma is a big deal. So, you know, if reincarnation wasn't taught by the Buddha, then how did he explain karma? And I mean, I'm just confused by the whole thing. So I wonder what you think about that.
No. The Buddha's teaching on karma is different than the Vedic teaching on karma. And the reincarnation doctrine was part of the Vedic teaching. The Vedic teachings, which were very widespread and widely accepted in the world at the Buddha's time, well, not in the world at all, but in that part of the world, certainly that part of India at that time. Before the Buddha was born, the general belief was that, and this had evolved over time from a much more moderate view of karma before, but by that point in time it had arrived at the point that everything that happened was believed by the Brahmins to be the result of karma. And karma is a word that means action, and that every action that you committed, every karma, produced some kind of a fruit which you would experience later on. And everything that happened to you today is the result of something that you did before. And that Vedic doctrine went hand in hand with the doctrine of reincarnation. They actually evolved together from earlier beliefs. And the reincarnation belief said that somebody who does bad things in the world may seem to get away with it and actually may seem to enjoy a lot of pleasure, but they're going to get theirs in their next incarnation. And bad things happen to good people. And when you see good people suffering all sorts of misfortune, they're burning off the karma from their past lives, and they're making karma so that they're going to be born, you know, if they happen to be an outcast or one of the lower castes, they now have a shot at being born into the warrior caste or the Brahmin caste, you know, and they're going to be in a much